passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to another Baseball America Prospects podcast. I'm Kyle Glazer, joined on the phone by Ben Badler. We're here to talk Blue Jays, and obviously, Ben, they've got a pretty intriguing system, topped by two of the most exciting young players in baseball, and two progeny of big leaguers, Vlad Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette. Ben, before we kind of dive into, you know, each guy individually, just overall, this duo, the fact they've climbed together, they're kind of associated with each other on a number of levels. How much are these guys kind of, you know, raising the excitement, not just of the Blue Jays system, but really just the entire franchise as a whole?
Yes, every time I write about the Blue Jays farm system or Vladdy and Bo, I mean, it just seems like these are the guys that Blue Jays fans are and very rightfully so, excited about. I think there's kind of an odd strategy, I think, that their front office is taking this year, where I think it makes a lot of sense to do like a one-year reset and try to trade away prospects, not tear everything down the way that the Braves did and go for like a multi-year tank and rebuild, but do something like the Yankees did a couple of years back and add prospects to the system and still be competitive in 2019, which is, you know, as young as Vladdy and Bo are, I think these guys can help them in 2019. I think these guys are both centerpiece, franchise, cornerstone type players. I'm definitely the high man in the office on Bo Bichette, but I mean, for me, Bo Bichette is a top five prospect in baseball. And for me, I think Ohtani is, you know, of all the players who have rookie eligibility and still prospect eligibility, I think Ohtani is the best of that group. But, you know, put him aside for a second, because he's a two-way player, a kind of a mutant in his own right, but I think Vladimir Guerrero Jr., after Ohtani, is the best prospect in baseball. So I think the system definitely takes a pretty steep dip after those top two guys. I mean, and especially at the top handful of players in the system, but that top two is the best top two prospects in baseball for me.
And I think a lot of people would agree with that. In terms of your discussions, you know, you mentioned the fan excitement about these guys, but obviously we at Baseball America talk a lot to farm directors, scouts, inside and outside the game. Beyond just fan excitement, did you sense an excitement both within the Blue Jays front office and even from outside scouts, like, hey, these guys are the real deal, it's not just hype because of the names and A-ball production?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, that's why... And that's why these guys are that's why there's so much excitement around these two guys, is that I think it's cool. It's kind of a cool story that, yeah, both these guys are coming up together and their dads played in the big leagues. And, you know, Vlad's dad is going to go, I assume, or he should go into the Hall of Fame this year. And so I understand that, but it's also... They're just two super talented players, whether his name is Vladimir Guerrero Jr. or just, you know, Jose Pena, it doesn't really matter what the name is. This both of these guys are just super, super talented, especially in the batter's box.
Absolutely. And you mentioned, you know, the Blue Jays maybe needing a one-year reset rather than a tank. And really, it's what Bichette and Guerrero can do for you in the batter's box. You look at the Blue Jays last year, you know, obviously 2015, 2016, back-to-back ALCSs. And the Blue Jays, I mean, they were bombers. Then you saw Edwin Encarnacion leave. Jose Bautista start to decline. You look at last year's everyday lineup. Every single one of these guys was, for the most part, a below-average hitter as measured by OPS+. Plus. Except for Justin Smoke and Josh Donaldson. I mean, seven of their nine everyday guys were below average offensively. You know, you have guys like Troy Tulowitzki and Russell Martin who, you know, you can say it's down years, but they're also about to be 33 and 35. Offense is in a lot of ways what the Blue Jays need, even though we associate them with a high-powered offense. These guys, tremendously talented. We also mentioned that they topped out in high A last year. How quickly do you think, because obviously guys get to the majors, but there's still an adjustment period once they get there. How quickly, realistically, is it for Vlad Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette to be having everyday consistent impacts in this Blue Jays lineup?
I think they could probably do it by the time they're, you know, 21, 22 years old. And, you know, both of these guys, I think, I don't know that it's a certainty that yet that they're going to start the season in double A together. But I, you know, certainly if I were their farm director, I would say these guys have nothing left to prove in high A. They both demolished the Florida State League last year. These are two kids who are super, super advanced and polished for their age and can handle the challenge of going to double A, even though they are so young and would be the youngest players in the Eastern League. And I don't see anything in their game that's going to cause them to hit a wall in double A next year. So I think you're looking at if the Blue Jays were, for example, if they were in a position where, and I would be surprised if this happened, but if they were in a position where they were playoff contenders by the, you know, by the All-Star break in 2018, and they needed help. Well, you know, similar to what the Red Sox did in 2017 with Rafael Devers, I think there's a chance that both of them could come up and be in the major leagues by the end of 2018. Now, I don't think the Blue Jays are going to be in that position, and I think that their front office, the people who are in their front office are a lot more conservative on promoting their prospects than that. I don't think you're going to see them push them so aggressively, although when you have players who are as talented and are dominating their leagues the way that Guerrero and Bichette did last year, they just sort of force their way up pretty quickly. But I think by 2019, I think both of these guys are going to be in the big leagues. And you're right. I mean, it's really hard to be, you know, an impact player when you're 20 years old at the major league level. But these guys are both super talented. I think by 2019, they're both going to be up. And certainly, I think by 2020, you've got a chance to see these guys both be above average players in that lineup.
No question. There's definitely a lot of reason to be optimistic about these two. Just real quick, you know, we know Vlad Guerrero Jr. Look, we know he's good. I remember talking a couple people about this when I was describing, you know, Fernando Tatis Jr. It wasn't, hey, is this guy a good prospect who will be a big leaguer? Yeah, we know it. It's just a matter of degrees. You know, how good? How good can Vlad Guerrero Jr. be?
I think he's talented enough where he's going to be in MVP conversations at some point in his career. I mean, remember, he's 18 years old. He's really the same age as all the high school players, you know, Royce Lewis, Mackenzie Gore, all these guys who were first-round picks out of high school in the draft this year and went to, you know, the Gulf Coast League or the Arizona League or you know, and even the super polished, advanced 18-year-old kids out of Latin America, a lot of them are still in the Gulf Coast League, or, you know, in the case of like a Leody Tavares or a Juan Soto, they might be in the South Atlantic League, but they're not dominating that league. Guerrero dominated that league as an 18-year-old, and then he went to the Florida State League and continued to just dominate again. And these are, again, he's 18 years old, and these are two very pitcher-friendly leagues. And to do what he did at that age in those two leagues is just incredible. And you look at him from a scouting perspective, in addition to the numbers he put up, I mean, you really can't – you really have to nitpick to find any holes in his offensive game. It's just it's really, really good bat speed, great bat control, just like his dad. He kind of has the same hitting mannerisms as his dad, but he's a much more disciplined hitter, too. He has a really, really outstanding sense for the strike zone. He squares up fastballs, squares up breaking balls. He stays within the strike zone. He has big, big-time power, too. So you have a guy who has a chance to be a top-of-the-scale hitter with outstanding plate discipline and, you know, probably going to have 60 to 70 raw power, maybe even more. I mean, he's still 18. It's hard to say what his power ceiling is. And the thing about him, too, is he just, you know, we ranked him as the number one international prospect when he signed in 2015. It's hard to say, like, a guy who was ranked number one was underrated, but he kind of was just because he keeps getting better at everything. He keeps getting better. When he was number one as a 16-year-old signing out of Dominican Republic because of his bat. I remember at that time he was an outfielder, and you know, he was a left fielder, didn't really run well, didn't throw well, but since signing, obviously he moved to third base. His arm has gotten stronger. He's even gotten faster. Now, speed is not going to be much of a part of his game, and I think the mobility is the long-term agility, and mobility is a concern at third base just because of how big he is right now as an 18-year-old. But he's gotten better defensively. He's gone from a guy who was just kind of a maybe left field guy in a best case scenario, but probably gets too big and goes to first base, to a guy who has really worked hard to improve defensively at third base to the point where there's a chance that he could start out his career at third base. So I think at some point, maybe by his mid-20s or so, he gets, you know, just so big that he goes to first base. But, I mean, I think that he's going to have, I mean, he's got a chance to be like a Manny Ramirez type of offensive player, and I don't really say that lightly by any means, but I think if you have that kind of bat, it doesn't matter where he plays on the field. That's going to be a premium elite level player.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned it too. I think one of the things that we consistently kept hearing over and over and over throughout the year was, hey, he's getting better at third base. He's getting better at third base. And even if it's only the first couple years of his career there, you know, it certainly doesn't hurt. It's helpful. And I think that's where, you know, you mentioned Manny Ramirez. I mean, people, you know, obviously there's always hesitation to compare any 18-year-old to any Hall of Famer, but you look like the career track of a Miguel Cabrera, of an Albert Pujols, you know, guys who came up, they were third baseman, they moved to first, and, you know, any insinuation that they're somehow less valuable or no longer the best player in baseball for a good chunk of years just because they played first base doesn't have any merit. And I think there's a sense that Vlad could be one of those guys.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm not that aggressive typically on players, especially if they're still 18 years old. But if you, I mean, he's a no doubt top five prospect in baseball. And if you can't be aggressive on somebody who's as talented as Vladdy Jr. is, then I don't know who you can be aggressive on.
Absolutely. And yeah, a lot of scouts who are naturally conservative are definitely saying, yeah, I believe in this guy. You know, Bo Bichette was a guy that, again, wasn't by any means an unknown coming into this year. He had a really good debut in the Gulf Coast League. you know, he was a second rounder for a high schooler. So while obviously that's not a top pick, you know, being taken, you know, still one of the, you know, day one as a high schooler, you're still one of the best players in the country at that given time. But he's just been so much better than it seems like anyone anticipated. In your discussions with both scouts inside and outside the organization, what have you found has been the general consensus on what has made Bo so much better even than I think everyone realized?
Yeah, it's interesting because I did our Gulf Coast League prospect list last year, and Shed, he got not injured. He had an issue with his appendix. It didn't require surgery, so he didn't play all that much in the Gulf Coast League, but when he did play, he was just super, super impressive. And talking to people there in that league, they said he was one of the best players in the league. So I was definitely high on Bichette coming into the year, and I think that people in high school just underestimated him. Some of it, I think he was getting pitched around in high school. I know I talked to scouts who scouted him, who were area scouts in Florida, and they said sometimes they just went in and saw him and they never actually got to see him swing the bat because he was just getting pitched around. And then I think, you know, I'd read some of the stuff, or heard some of the stuff about his swing, about people having concerns about his swing. I don't share any of those concerns at all. I think he has a great swing. He's got a lot of rhythm. He's got balance. He's got outstanding bat speed and plane through the hitting zone. Barrel stays through the zone forever. So he just has more margin for error. And he's got big power too. And he's a smart hitter. So I think there's a lot of things that a lot of attributes that he has and a lot of great hitters have. Now, I didn't think he was going to hit, you know, just completely demolish the Midwest League and then the Florida State League like he did this year. I think he has a lot of the characteristics that you see in a lot of the great hitters in the major leagues.
You know, you mentioned the swing, and it's interesting. I just in the course of the season, calling various scouts, talking about various players, and obviously, you know, wanted to ask, hey, early in the year, what do you see from this guy? And I just want to read the report I got, and it's, you know, it speaks to that a little bit, how I think sometimes people want to see almost a cookie cutter swing approach sometimes, and, you know, doesn't always work that way. The exact quotes I got were, you know, on offense, he always got the barrel to the ball. He's got a severe wrap around his head. He's got a funky setup I didn't really care for, but he got to good fastballs, bad fastballs, breaking balls. He was hitting everything and hitting it hard. So you got to believe he may be one of those special guys who can do a funky approach and get away with it. He's got good hand-eye coordination, barreled the ball, showed gap power. You know, again, I think it just speaks to a little bit. There's, and look, in all industries, this isn't just scouting. You know, sometimes individuals are risk averse to something that's a little out of the ordinary. And I think it's a testament, you know, for Bo. A lot of scouts I've talked to said, yeah, they believe that even though maybe something might not be traditional, you know, after seeing it work, even at just the A-ball levels, they think it will work moving forward all the way up to the major leagues.
Yeah, I don't even see anything all that funky in what he does. I mean, he has a leg kick in his swing. It's to helps him generate power. He's consistently on time and on plane with the baseball. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think that's the only scout who holds that opinion, but I just totally disagree with it. I think he has a really great swing. I think he does a lot of things that a lot of great major league hitters do, and I definitely agree with the part about the hand-eye coordination and the barrel of the ball skills. He definitely has that, and outstanding bat speed and power. I think the power is only going to continue to increase as he gets older and stronger and just becomes a more mature hitter. I mean, he's already mature for his age in terms of his approach and hitting knowledge, but even as that grows and he becomes even a more selective hitter, and a smarter hitter, and he has a better idea of how pitchers are trying to attack him. He's going to swing at even better pitches, and he's going to see that power jump up even more.
Now, defensively, it seemed throughout the year a lot of people were saying, you know, he is a guy that will have to move to second base. But even again, if he does, you're still talking about more than enough offensive production to justify a top prospect in all of baseball. Just defensively in general, you know, the scouts you spoke to throughout this process, what were the overall, you know, assumptions about where he's going to have to be defensively when all is said and done?
For me, I think it's the combination of things. One is how much better he gets defensively at shortstop, and two, I think some of it's just circumstantial, depending on who he plays with, like who his teammates are. If he's teammates, you know, with somebody like, you know, an Adani Echevarria or Brandon Crawford or someone who, you know, Alcides Escobar, somebody who's more of a traditional, like, true shortstop, then, yeah, Bichette's probably going to go to either second base or third base. And I think if he goes to either of those spots, he has a chance to be an above-average defender there. But I think there's a higher probability that Bichette stays at shortstop now than I would have given him coming into the year, you know, at this time, you know, a year ago. I think he got better defensively. He's not flashy. He's not going to make any of the acrobatic plays that are, I was going to say, get on SportsCenter, but I don't think I've watched SportsCenter in 10 years, and I don't even know. I guess maybe the more appropriate would be get him on Instagram or some other highlight reel. But so he's not going to make those super flashy plays, but I think he can be somebody who's just a fundamentally sound player who has a strong arm, has a clock for the game. I think he's got to improve his footwork and improve his range to the best that he can, at least. I don't think that's ever going to be plus, but I think that I think he has a chance to stay at that position, and I think there's a lot of guys who we've seen defy expectations and stay at shortstop, whether that's you know, Addison Russell coming out of high school, where people were concerned about whether he was going to stay at shortstop, or Xander Bogaerts, Corey Seager, and these guys, you know, some of them not only have stayed at shortstop, but have become above-average defenders at that position. And I don't have that expectation for Bichette, but I do think I would certainly keep him at shortstop for now, and I do think there's a possibility that he can stay at shortstop. I wouldn't just assume that he's going to go to third base or second base. But I do think that, you know, depending on, you know, how much better he gets and who his teammates are in the future, there's a pretty good chance that he goes over to second base or third base. And if he does, he can be an above-average defender at either of those spots.
Absolutely. So these top two we know are kind of head and shoulders above the rest of the Blue Jays group. Going into that 3-4-5 range, you know, you had Anthony Alford, Nate Pearson, Lourdes Gurriel, and Eric Pardino, their big offseason or international signing, I should say. What went into the decision to kind of, you know, group these guys? Some of the names that maybe have been on this top 10 list in the past, some of the pitchers, high picks, Sean Reed Foley, TJ Zoic, Connor Green, guys like that who ends up dropping below these guys. Just what was kind of the process in determining that, you know, Alford, Pearson, Gurriel, at the very least, were kind of that 3-4-5 group?
I mean, the guys after that, you know, 3 through 7 or 8 or so group, a lot of them just had a lot of really disappointing years from a lot of their pitchers. You know, Reed Foley, Connor Green, John Harris, TJ Zoic. Zoic was more health than anything else, but even Richard Urania, who's still in the top 10, but had a pretty disappointing year. So a lot of those guys, that's some real concern. They just kind of dropped themselves in the rankings given the seasons that they had. But Anthony Alford had a really nice year for himself. Guy's a good athlete, good sense for the strike zone, bat to ball skills, good defense in center field at a premium position. He had success this year at Double A. He's going to be probably starting in the upper minors this season, and should get back to Toronto by the end of the year. So that combination of performance, athleticism, defense at a premium position in the middle of a diamond and being at the upper levels, that to me, that separated him as the number three guy in the system.
Absolutely. You know, I wanted to talk about Lourdes Gurriel. Obviously, this is a guy who came in with quite a bit of fanfare, really struggled with some injuries this first year, and overall, the numbers on paper weren't great. What was the kind of feedback you were getting from scouts who saw him here his first year in the States?
So, with Gurriel, I mean, he's the one guy I think who probably sticks out as, wait, why is this guy ranked where he's ranked given his performance, which I think is understandable, but I think we have to look at performance, especially his performance, two ways, right? Like we use performance to measure a player's value and his contribution of what he's done in the past, but that's obviously not really what we're trying to do. We're trying to project these players going forward, and we can use the performance data to try to project a player going forward too. But in his case, we're talking about a pretty small sample size of performance. If we're just looking at 2017, where he, I think he had 66 at bats in high A and then 170 at bats in Double A. And a lot of that was, he played in April and May, and then most of June, he didn't really play except for one game until June 19th. So, we have a Cuban player who is making a transition to a new country, which, it is a factor, but really more than anything, he hadn't really played competitive baseball since, I think it must have been, January or maybe February of 2016. So I mean, he really had been away from having competitive game at bats for a while. So once he gets in there, I think it's understandable for a guy to have an adjustment period to get your timing back, to get used to playing in competitive baseball games. I mean, I understand he's working out and he's facing some live pitching when he's doing tryouts and, when he's in spring training with the Blue Jays, but so much of hitting is timing, and I think it's understandable that his timing may have been off, especially, just given his skill set and given his circumstances, that would be the case for him. So, look, it may be the case where he comes back next year and hits the same as he did this year, and in that case, his stock would drop significantly. But I think in his case, there are some circumstances that I look at that say, you know what, if you're just looking at a performance, you're not really getting a true sense of this guy's present or true talent level. I don't think that really tells the story of him. And that's whether you're looking at performance or whether you're just scouting him and looking at what he's doing on the field this year, because I think there's legitimate reason to believe that this guy's timing was off this year. It's not really fair to judge him strictly on what he did in 2017. If you've seen this guy, which I have for the last several years, you can see the larger body of work and see what he looks like when he's at his best. I think that's more indicative of what to expect going forward, but definitely 2018 is going to be a big season for him to show that 2017 was more of a fluke or an aberration, and that he can put that behind him.
You know, we've talked a lot about a lot of guys in this system who had down years. I want to touch on one more before we end on a high note. You know, Rowdy Tellez had a really, really strong year at Double A in 2016. Went to AAA this year, 222, 295, 333. Played, almost the whole season, only six home runs. You know, for a first base power guy, it was clearly a, well, it's a disappointing season for anybody, but especially a first base power guy. What for you was the main issues there that you found discussed mostly by scouts and front office officials?
Yeah, everything just seemed to fall apart for him this year. He, I think there's some bat speed concerns. I've always been a little bit lower on him, I think, than some other people have been. So I certainly didn't expect him to completely crater the way he did in AAA this past season. But the power wasn't there. there's just nothing seemed to go his way this year. And like you said, you just can't really be in any position and hit like that. But especially as a first baseman, that's some pretty big red flags with him, and he's his stock definitely dropped quite a bit this season.
You know, one thing is, came out during the season, he was playing through his mother was battling cancer, and so there's definitely, obviously, anytime you have something like that happening, there's a lot of things going on in your mind and your life beyond just baseball. Was there any sense, again, talking to individuals, both inside and outside the system, that they felt that some of his struggles were maybe, related to, that, or were there some physical things that they felt might have been independent of it? I mean, how much, from your perception, was it that versus, true physical shortcomings, if you will?
It's hard to play like a psychologist from a distance or even up close. It's hard to say how much of any player's struggles are physical versus mental, but the bottom line is he's just got to hit better. I mean, you can't have a 628 OPS as a first baseman. I mean, I think the good thing with the track record on him at pretty much every level is he's hit up through every level of A ball through double A. So he's still in the handbook, but really based on the track record prior to 2017, but the 2017 season definitely saw his stock drop.
Absolutely. So, we're going to wrap up here. I want to finish on a high note. Again, a lot of these guys, Zoik and Reed Foley and McGuire and Harris, a lot of the pitchers didn't have great years. The other side of the battery, though, saw a really promising year from Danny Jansen. He was a guy that got glasses, and obviously you can't hit, you can't see, and getting glasses made a world of difference. Shot up to AAA this year, was probably the biggest riser in the system, just look rankings-wise from where he was to where he is now. Is this the Blue Jays' everyday catcher of the future post Russell Martin?
He could be. I think there's a chance that he could be an everyday guy. It's not somebody who's going to do anything that's going to wow you. I don't even think he has a plus tool in his card. But I don't think you need to have one to be an everyday catcher. And in the big leagues, it's nothing flashy, but it's a guy who puts the bat to the ball pretty consistently, has a good grasp of the strike zone, recognizes pitches, doesn't expand the strike zone, gives you just enough power as a catcher. Is that more of like a Josh Tolley type of skill set as somebody who you can run out there as a catcher at the big leagues? Maybe. I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily an everyday guy, but I think he's sort of just on that cusp of somebody who has a chance to be an everyday guy, even though he's not going to do anything that really jumps out to you with a cannon arm or 70 power or anything too flashy. I think he's just got a chance to be a really steady catcher at the big league level.
Yeah, there's something to be said for having a steady catcher at the big league level. I think, as you discussed, this there's no plus tool, and this is a guy who, while he obviously was known before, this was his big breakout year. I think there's a lot of just a little bit of wait and see, like, okay, let's see how real this was. Did you get that sense at all discussing things with evaluators?
To some sense, yeah. I mean, he's at this point, he's hit in Double A. He's hit in kind of a pretty small sample size, obviously, in Triple A. I think the main test for him is going to come at the major league level. How much of that is going to translate at that level? Which, you know, obviously sounds kind of obvious, but yeah. I mean, for a guy he's not going to do anything that wows you. But he just pretty consistently puts the bat to the ball, gets on base, has just enough power, I think, for that skill set to translate at the next level.
Absolutely. And then finally, the Blue Jays did receive a little bit of an influx this year. They had two first-round picks, four of the top 100 picks. And, you know, a lot of the guys they took were fairly well-known names. Logan Warmuth, Nate Pearson, Hagen Danner had been a SoCal high school star for some time, Riley Adams, an All-American catcher. You know, they had four picks. They took four fairly well-known, accomplished guys for their level. And, you know, you have Nate Pearson ranked the highest. Just overall, what were the early reviews on this draft class they took in?
I mean, yeah, I think the main guy to watch from that class is Pearson. It's surprising to me that he was still available where they got him with the 28th pick in the draft. I'm not involved in putting together our BA 500, but we had him at number 13 on our board, and the Blue Jays got him at the end of the first round. I think that's tremendous value for that pick. You know, he was drafted behind Logan Warmuth, and I think it's pretty evident at this stage that Pearson is the better prospect. I think his stuff just continues to tick up as the year went along. And pretty consistently mid-upper 90s, touching 101. As his fastball got better, his slider got better too. He just started throwing that pitch with more power and really just overpowered hitters in the Northwest League. So he's a guy I'm pretty excited about, and definitely the Blue Jays are pretty excited about too. So this guy's got a chance to be a power arm starter for them, potentially a mid rotation starter. He, you know, there's a chance maybe he elevates that projection as he pitches in 2018. I'll have to wait and see what the results are, but there's a lot of really exciting things to like about Nate Pearson.
Absolutely. All right, I think we'll end it on that high note. Ben, thank you so much for joining us, and clearly a lot to look forward to in the Blue Jays system. For Ben Badler, I'm Kyle Glazer. Thanks for listening, everybody.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.